Welcome to AgriPulse Newsmakers, where we aim to take you to the heart of ag policy. I'm Spencer Chase. Our guest this week is USDA Farm Production and Conservation Undersecretary Robert Bonney, who joins us to discuss the Biden administration's climate agenda for the agriculture industry. But first, here's this week's headlines. Grocery prices held steady in the June Consumer Price Index. Drops in dairy, pork, and egg prices were offset by higher prices for beef, chicken, fruits, and vegetables. Food prices are 4.7% higher year over year. The overall CPI rose by 0.2%, largely due to higher housing costs. USDA's monthly World Agricultural Supply and Demand Estimates report maintained record corn production estimates despite drought conditions. The department estimates more than 15 billion bushels of corn will be produced this year. Drought conditions lowered USDA's yield forecast, but an increase in planted acres more than made up for the losses. Soybean yield projections were unchanged, setting up a tight ending stock scenario for the crop. Next month's report is expected to offer a better idea of the weather's impact on the country's corn and soybean production as the crops continue to mature. And finally, USDA is investing $300 million from the Inflation Reduction Act to measure carbon sequestration and greenhouse gas emissions. The department announced the funding alongside a broader Biden administration strategy to improve monitoring and measurement in agriculture and forestry. Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack says the rollout will centralize USDA's sprawling data into a more organized manner and add more figures to the calculations. Undersecretary Robert Bonney heads up USDA's Farm Production and Conservation Mission Area, giving him a key role in shaping how the federal government handles the intersection of agriculture and climate change. He says the data collected through this investment will be critical.
Well, I think it's not only what USDA stands to gain, but actually what American agriculture stands to gain as well. What we've done, these are dollars from the Inflation Reduction Act that are intended to improve the way we measure soil carbon, measure methane and nitrous oxide emissions, that improve our data, that provide better models, better tools to producers so that they can understand as they decide whether to employ climate smart practices, what the implications of those are. It speeds up our data gathering. One of the challenges we have is that agriculture, our data is sometimes dated, meaning it's older. We've actually done a bunch of conservation, need to get recognition for it, but don't have the data. This will make U.S. agriculture look better. It will help markets by providing better information so that producers can get value from their climate smart practices. And it's an opportunity here for us to showcase what agriculture has done. And these are investments that will be moving forward to, in partnership with agriculture to improve the way we measure, monitor the deployment of climate smart agricultural practices.
When Secretary Vilsack was discussing this announcement on a call with reporters, he talked about not only the existing data and synergizing that, but also collecting some new data. What is that new data, that new information that the USDA and producers across the country need?
We want to have a better idea of the implications of various nitrogen management practices, for example, on nitrous oxide emissions, which is a powerful greenhouse gas. Want better science around soil carbon so we get a better understanding of how practices influence soil carbon. So it's both the existing data we have now, making it richer, but those new places where we don't have as much information, having more robust information. And again, agriculture is doing a lot of climate smart practices out there. This will allow us to get credit for that.
I wonder, in not only this endeavor, but also in some of the others that you're looking to kind of track, carbon sequestration, greenhouse gas emissions, et cetera. A lot of that, I have to imagine, you're going to need, acre by acre, maybe even square inch by square inch data in some cases. How do you balance the need for that data collection with the desire on the part of many producers across the country to maintain their privacy?
Yeah, well, privacy is going to be critical in all this. We have to make sure that none of this data impacts any confidentiality or otherwise, and we're required by the Farm Bill to do that. What we can do if we have better data and can understand that data by various soil types, geographies, and others, it allows us to provide tools, anonymous tools, where producers can estimate the impact of climate smart practice themselves, or if folks they're working with can do that. And so this actually will help producers have better information, keep it anonymous, and allow them to take advantage of emerging markets for climate smart commodities, you know, carbon and other things.
We'll talk Partnership for Climate Smart Commodities with USDA Undersecretary Robert Bonney right after this.
Regenerative poultry production is a process by which nature can actually recapture and restore the energy that is being taken out of a space.
Farm Credit helped Rahi build his dream of regenerative poultry farming and encouraging fellow immigrants to find community in agriculture.
Nothing beats a farm. I'm just pursuing happiness.
Learn more at farmcredit.com/beginning.
Farmers are always there for each other. We shed tears together. We celebrate together. But we also grow together. Farm Bureau is the largest general farm organization in the country. We have the farmers back. If you're a farmer and you're not a member, we would welcome you into our Farm Bureau family. And if you want to know more about agriculture, come be part of this great family.
Welcome back. USDA Undersecretary Robert Bonney says the department is just about to switch to the smaller part of its landmark Partnerships for Climate Smart Commodities initiative.
We have 141 projects that have been announced. We have 70 in the first round, which are the larger projects, and we have 71 in the second round. We've completed negotiations of all the first round projects up to about, I think we have four or five left that we're still completing the negotiations. So the agreements are either signed or close to being signed. We've already started in the second round, bringing in folks and signing agreements, doing a lot of negotiations there. And we're starting to hear from folks out in the field some demand as they start to enroll producers in these programs and otherwise. And a couple of weeks ago, we had our first meeting of the Partnerships Network, the larger proposals, to talk about implementation of those and things we could learn together. So Partnerships is moving forward. We're excited about it and think that a lot of folks out in the field are as well.
How does this work in terms of making sure the funding that you have can stretch out over the lifetime of these contracts? Because I imagine many of them will need to be tied to the growing season. And, you know, we're well into the 23 growing season, so practices might not be able to be applied to this crop. Are you going to be able to stretch the funding that you've got for another year to incorporate the delay in some of these, the signing of these contracts?
Yeah, we are. So we've taken the dollars, we've set aside the dollars that we're using for the program, and our expectation is that we'll be paying out over the length of these projects, 5 years, 4 year projects. And so, yes, we've got the resources set aside. We're working with the partners to make sure that we pay on a timely basis so they can and then work with their producers and make sure payment flows down to the ground.
From the outside looking in, I mean, this was a situation where many of these projects were announced last fall, the first contract signing happening at Commodity Classic the following spring. I mean, I know you and your colleagues, feel like you've probably been working incredibly hard to do this, but it does, from the outside looking in, seem like it took a little while to get pen to paper on some of these deals. And in your estimation, from someone who's a lot closer to the situation than I am, what was it, do you think, that ultimately led to that extended timeline?
Well, some of these agreements are actually quite large. You know, we've got $90 million contracts. They're complicated. We're both making sure that we deploy the resources in a way that get down to the ground to farmers and others. We need to be clear about what we're paying for, and some of the projects have brought in matching funding. So it's not without complication. Frankly, we're learning as we do this, as are the partners as well. We're moving as quickly as we can and expect, as I say, projects are starting to roll out now.
We've seen some efforts on Capitol Hill on the appropriation side of the House and on the Farm Bill side in the Senate. We saw marker legislation this week that would restrict the use of the Commodity Credit Corporation. This program has been cited as in a number of those cases. Are you concerned about the potential effects that legislation like that might have on future initiatives, not only for things like Partnerships for Climate Smart Commodities, but future CCC flexibility?
Well, the CCC offers significant tools to USDA to be able to deal with a variety of challenges that are faced by agriculture. For example, we've done a lot of work around fertilizer inputs and ways that we can help producers there. On the climate smart commodities side, we're creating markets for new commodities. We're bolstering markets so that producers can do better, so that we can showcase U.S. agriculture. We think that tools provided in the Commodity Credit Corporation are critical. We've used them well. We've worked closely to make sure we're adhering to the letter of the law. So we're very confident in that. And obviously the last administration used the Commodity Credit Corporation, we would argue, in a pretty significant way to deal with some of the trade impacts. So we think we need the flexibility of this tool. And we've tried to build these tools in ways that work for agriculture. We want to do this with agriculture. That was an important part of the Partnerships for Climate Smart Commodities. So part of our interest here is making sure agriculture is supporting what we are doing. And we think if agriculture and forestry support what we're doing, that that puts us in pretty good stead up on Capitol Hill and elsewhere.
We'll be right back to discuss this week's USDA reports with our panel. But first, our Hannah Pegel takes a look at a typical farm bill timeline in this week's Ag by the Numbers.
If previous timelines hold, there's a strong chance the next farm bill won't be ready by the end of this year, or maybe not even next year. This chart shows the total number of days needed to pass each of the last four farm bills. The average reauthorization process for these bills lasted 550 days. It took less than 300 days to pass the 2002 and 2018 farm bills. But the 2008 and 2014 farm bills both took more than 800 days to become law. The next farm bill will face some of the same challenges as the reauthorizations that came before it, but some unique factors will be at play as well. The narrow and split control of Congress and the White House will likely require lawmakers to move a compromise bill rather than one party's priorities. But hardline conservatives in the House could push for changes that would be non-starters for more liberal or even moderate voters in the Senate, or the other way around. There's also the upcoming election, which will decide control of Capitol Hill and the executive branch. You can read more about how each bill became law and get a title-by-title breakdown of the current process in our coverage on AgriPulse.com. For AgriPulse, I'm Hannah Pegel.
Who mapped the soybean genome? You did. Who's replacing the petroleum and asphalt? You are. Who created biodiesel that increased your income 63 cents per bushel? You again. When you pool your resources through your soy checkoff, you're making sales, you're making breakthroughs that all come back to your bottom line. That's you. That's who. As your soy checkoff, moving soy forward, moving you forward.
It's not as simple as just to wake up one day and go, I want to be a conservation farmer. You're changing how your farming practice is done. You're changing your operation.
Farm Credit supported John and Kelly Watley as they shifted to more sustainable farming, improving the environment where they farm and live. Learn more at farmcredit.com/climate.
Welcome back to AgriPulse Newsmakers, where we're going to have a panel discussion on the recent USDA WASDE report, as well as some other things that economists are watching heading into the future. Joined for that conversation by Arlen Suderman with StoneX and Barrett Nelson with the American Farm Bureau Federation. Appreciate both of you taking the time to join us. And Arlen, I want to go to you first, because obviously the July WASDE report did show us some interesting things, but almost immediately after the ink was barely dry on the report, the trade was saying, let's wait till the August one. That's when we're really going to learn something. So what are you going to be keeping an eye on between the publication of this week's WASDE report and that next WASDE report coming in August?
Oh, I think the number one story now is going to be weather. Yield is going to be driving it, and how the weather is going to impact that yield. We had a lot of stress in the month of June on the crops, and we still have some areas under stress now, but we've really gone into a more favorable weather pattern. So to what degree will the crops be able to heal? I've been very concerned about the slowness of the soybean crop to respond right now, and it's really the soybean balance sheets that's the tightest. Now, the market was very disappointed with this WASDE report in the fact that USDA printed a 300 million bushel ending stocks estimate for 23-24 soybeans when the trade was looking for 199 million bushels. But the primary difference was that USDA chose to wait till August to adjust its yield for soybeans. And I think that's very understandable they did that. But the margin for error is very small. If you keep their demand estimates the same and you drop the yield one bushel, all of a sudden you're at 217 million bushels or a 5% stocks to use ratio. And so there's very little margin for error. Weather is going to be the primary factor.
So we focus so much and so obviously on the American commodity markets and the American production, but I do wonder, as you look around the world, how do you think current global production and current global production estimates are impacting American commodity markets?
Well, the big impact has come from Brazil, where we're seeing Brazil farmers right now swimming in corn and soybeans because of their expansion in production. Right now, they're swimming in red ink because of that as their very weak basis. So they don't have much incentive to expand this next year, but they've got a lot of supplies of corn and soybeans they're continuing to sell. That's hurting our demand right now, particularly combined with currency exchange rate advantages that they have. The break in the dollar should help. But overall, that's a big problem, and that's overshadowing any problems with the Ukraine Grain Initiative right now.
Barron, I want to shift things over to you now. You know, Arlen mentioned that $300 million carryover figure in the soybean complex. I had another analyst yesterday tell me that was his biggest shock that he saw in the report. I wonder, what would that figure, do you think, mean for global soybean markets?
You know, what it really means is that they slashed demand. When we look at a figure like that coming in, you know, $100 million under expectations, that really kind of tells you what they're looking at as far as global demand goes. And Arlen really said it straight when he said, you know, we have some renewable fuel initiatives and things of that nature in the United States to kind of offset that. But overall, on the global scale, that was a pretty big shock.
We'll be right back with more from our panel right after this.
Did you know AgriPulse has all your favorite podcasts, including Open Mic, Newsmakers, and Drive Time? Take us wherever you go. Subscribe at AgriPulse.com or on Spotify, Google Play, or Apple Podcasts.
Agriculture Future of America is a nonprofit building transformational leaders in food and agriculture. AFA prepares college students to join the workforce as innovative and engaged young professionals who will shape the future of agriculture. Head to agfuture.org to find out how you can get involved.
The Senate and House Ag Committees are busy working on the next farm bill, which will cover commodities, specialty crops, livestock, and more. This legislation will impact every farmer, rancher, and rural business for the next 5 years. Make sure you don't miss insights and analytics that only AgriPulse and its top-notch team of well-connected experts can provide. Register today for a free trial at agripulse.com and click the subscribe button, or email us at pam@agri-pulse.com. You don't want to miss this farm bill coverage.
Welcome back. Farm Bureau's Barron Nelson says the weather has been a primary factor in American commodity markets so far this year, something he expects will continue.
You know, we've been in a weather market since June. We saw this the crop get planted, and we didn't see rain show up for quite a while. So there was a lot of topsoil moisture recently that was added to this. And this is coming off of a triple dip La Nina event. So we had back-to-back-to-back drought years in much of the United States. Now, when we got that crop in, there was some soil moisture there, but we had, you know, a month where we saw some crop damage. And we saw corn yields come down that little bit because of that, coming, you know, down from 181.5 bushels, which was trend line, down to 177.5. So we're seeing some of that factor in. Now, we've seen 3 to 7 inches of rain across the Corn Belt in the last 2 weeks. There has been some moisture replenishing. The question is that enough to really keep things going? And as Arlen stated earlier, all eyes are going to be on this weather. When we're talking about a record crop production year in the forecast.
So I want to look forward now and talk about future acreage expectations for the U.S., maybe not necessarily this year, but in years to come. We do see the war, the invasion of Ukraine continuing to linger on. No really sign of any kind of early ends to that conflict. I do wonder, is there potential for any kind of long-term acreage changes within the U.S.? Because obviously when that conflict started, a lot of folks wondering, hey, you know, maybe there's a little bit more money to be made in the wheat market. Is there potential to include that kind of shift in American production, or do you think the preference for corn and soybean acreage across many of the row crop parts of the country is going to stick?
So when we talk about a shift in production or acreage, you're talking a little bit more of a long-term type situation. What happened with the Russian invasion of Ukraine, we were worried about food security for the first time in a very long time. You know, when we see the Ukraine ranking at number 6 in corn and number 7 in wheat production, those are some big numbers. And so the uncertainty between that or in that grain corridor for exports, it really creates some volatility. Now, when we're talking about an acreage shift, we're talking a little bit about risk and, you know, profitability. In order for a farmer to really want to shift acreage over, there needs to be an incentive. And that incentive can come in terms of risk or, you know, in offering a price. And so wheat, a lot of times by a farmer, is seen as more of a safe bet, you know, compared to the input requirement for like corn, for example. So in order to see that, they need to be compensated for that. And if wheat prices would come up enough for a long enough period of time, that's what it would take to see a long-term acreage shift. It will take a little bit more than short-term price incentives.
Arlen, I want to wrap up talking to you and bringing the Ukrainian conversation to your doorstep. Wondering, you know, obviously there were some short-term impacts on global commodity markets during the invasion as a result of, you know, shipping challenges, things of that nature. I do wonder, are there things you're watching in terms of market resets as a result of this conflict? You know, any potential longer-term impacts of this invasion?
Yeah, the market is pretty much adjusted right now for the risks of grain coming out of Ukraine. They're still finding ways to get it out. The Ukraine Grain Initiative looks to be coming to an end. Even if it's extended, we're probably talking about a slower pace. But they're going to try to do it on their own without Russia if it doesn't. But we're going to see some grain come out of there. And right now, Brazil's providing enough corn and Russia's providing enough cheap wheat. So that the world's really not too concerned about it. If there's a risk going forward to keep our eyes on, is there something to risk that the production coming out of Russia, Russia being a major supplier of crude oil to the world as well as wheat, and if something were to escalate, that would put that at risk, particularly if we started seeing threats to Ukrainian ships trying to do it on their own, and then counterattacks on Russian ships that would drop ships of both countries coming out of the Black Sea down, that could be a risk. I would say the risk of that is low, but it's one that we have to respect right now, because if you start slowing the movement of commodities out of Russia, that's a total game changer for the commodities, both for the crude oil market and for the wheat market.
Well, the global markets and the American markets certainly have quite a bit of things to keep an eye on here going forward, not only between now and that next report, but also in the long game as we watch the global implications of the geopolitics and the agriculture industry. I think that's going to do it for now. Arlen, Barrett, thanks for joining us. We'll be right back with more AgriPulse Newsmakers, but first, our Hannah Pegel has a look at drought conditions across the country in this week's Map It Out.
Despite some recent rain, Midwest producers are wondering if this year's drought could mean a repeat of dry years like 2012. Here's a look at the current drought conditions across the country. Most of the drought currently stretches from Kansas to Wisconsin. Kansas, Missouri, and eastern Nebraska have some of the worst conditions right now. It's important to see how this year's conditions compare to what we've seen before. This set of maps shows what the Federal Drought Monitor looked like this time last year. You can see some big changes for the Corn Belt and Southern Plains and improved conditions across the West. The next comparison shows the differences between now and peak drought conditions in September of 2012, when most of the central part of the country was facing extreme drought. USDA's most recent crop progress report showed 14% of the country's corn and 15% of its beans are rated either poor or very poor. Noah Wicks has more about the drought's impacts on producers in his article on AgriPulse.com. For AgriPulse, I'm Hannah Pegel.
Who mapped the soybean genome? You did. Who's replacing the petroleum and asphalt? You are. Who created biodiesel that increased your income 63 cents per bushel? You again. When you pool your resources through your soy checkoff, you're making sales. You're making breakthroughs that all come back to your bottom line. That's you. That's who. As your soy checkoff, moving soy forward, moving you forward.
Looking closer, seeing further. That's how we do it. At Curious Plot, we're driven to find what's next for agriculture, animal care, and food. We stay curious because that's what it takes to grow understanding. That's how we plot strategies and tell stories that get results time after time. Marketing, communications, and consulting that look closer and see further. Curious Plot. We can't wait to help you tell your story.
Thanks again for tuning in for another episode of AgriPulse Newsmakers. Before we let you go, here's what's on the horizon for the upcoming week. A Senate Ag Subcommittee will hold a hearing on Wednesday on modernizing rural water systems. The Senate Environment and Public Works Committee will hold hearings Thursday on the Water Resources Development Act. And the National Corn Growers Association will hold its annual Corn Congress in the nation's capital. We'll keep an eye on all of that and more on AgriPulse.com. For AgriPulse Newsmakers, I'm Spencer Chase. Have a good one.
Newsmakers is a production of AgriPulse Communications. For more ag policy news, visit AgriPulse.com. You can also find our new content on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to follow AgriPulse and our correspondents on social media to get breaking news and more.